Rabbi Joel Padowitz, Magid Shir in the Shul, and the Talmud of the Rav for more than 20 years.
I'll ask for mechila from the tzibur and the family for a number of counts. The first is my heart is really still broken and I'm pretty fragile, so if I begin to cry, you'll just give me a moment to regain my composure. You will regain your composure, it'll be okay. We'll get through it together. The second is I was asked to speak until Rav Yitzchak Horovitz arrives, so that means you'll forgive me if I speak long or short, as the case may be. And the third is I'm going to, because of nature, I don't know how long I'll be speaking for. What I'm going to say is probably not an appropriate hesped in as much as the Nechemi did to capture the most of the Rav, and Rav Stein did to capture the whole spectrum of his life. I'm going to give you small things. Anecdotes, perhaps, silly things, even that as a standalone has to be unsatisfactory, but to add color, I think, could be very valuable. And as far as I understand, the point of a hesbid is twofold. First is to really appreciate what we've lost, and second of all, to really understand what the Nifter stood for and his legacy, so the legacy can live on. So I will try my very best to convey some of that, what we've lost and what the Rav stood for, so that Ezra Hashem, his legacy can and will continue. So I was offered to be the Rav's Talmud and Charus for 22 years since he came to Eretz Yisrael. And I started Eish HaTorah. So the Rav was Yesodos, fundamentals, basics, was really essential to the Rav. So when he came to Eish HaTorah, just like in Ur Sameach, they didn't really trust him, they didn't want to let him in. And Rav Noach Weinberg, Rav Noach asked him what I think Rav Noach asked every prospective Eish Hayri, which is, can you tell me the six Sheish Mitzvot Medias? So that played into his strong suit, and Rav Linowitz was certainly able to tell him. The truth is, Emma says Rav Linowitz actually knew five out of six, because he conflated the Aseh of Yichud Hashem with the Lav of the Lo Yilecha, but that was good enough for Rav Noach. So they let him in, and but they were tentative on how much to trust him. So the full extent of his initial exposure was just to learn with me one person. That was a trial, I guess. So Rav Linowitz, understandably, for if you knew him, what did we start learning? We learned Tur Beis Yosef Hilchos Talmud Torah, not Gemara. That was the first thing we learned. Every Beis Yosef, I think, and Hilchos Talmud Torah. Because that Yisodos, everything had to have a foundation, everything had to be built from the bottom up, which is why he went to Rav Abba's, because he really felt that in Lakewood he couldn't get to the bedrock. He wanted to understand the bedrock. You know, one of the people who he admired, in a way, was this fellow Richard Feynman. So Richard Feynman was a scientist, he was a Jew as it happens, but he was an atheist. But Feynman, who was perhaps the greatest scientist of the 20th century after Einstein. So he was famous for, he developed something called quantum electrodynamics, pretty complicated stuff, and he had developed the Feynman diagrams, which was a way to with a schematic, with a picture, convey something rather abstract and difficult. And that is what Rav Linowitz loved to do, and every sugya he felt almost compelled to map it out with cute little diagrams. I think much as you'd sort of imagine that you would diagram a sentence from grade school, he would actually diagram each sugya to make sure that all the pieces fit together. You understand every component and the mechanics of the sugya to make sure it was clear. And that's what he told me to learn, just like that, from the beginning, from the ground up. Once I brought one, later on in my life, I had a student of my own, so I brought one of my talmidim to his sukkah. He loved that sukkah. Whichever boys built him that sukkah on the Michal, what he called his chazanish sukkah, he loved that sukkah. The Rav, as a child, hated sukkahs because he had to take his little turn on the lower side and then he would have to leave. So he promised himself when he has his own sukkah, he'll stay there. And the Rav had great sympathy on that sukkah. So once I came to visit him in the sukkah, with my Talmidim, and the Talmud was at Eish HaTorah, and he was troubled why he had this, he was just started there, and why he was spending so much time learning Gemara. So he asked Rav Linowitz, how come I learned Gemara? It's so technical, so many details, it's such a big picture. So I spoke out of turn, and I said, I'll tell you the truth. If it were up to me, Talmidim in Eish HaTorah wouldn't learn Gemara for a whole year. So the Rav said, what? A year? At least two. If I would sum up the Rav in my words, I would paint the picture of an Eved. I don't know if you would use those words, but we don't have much experience, Bezman Hazeh, with real Avadim. One of the Rav's favorite books, as it happens, was a book called Every Man a Slave, which portrayed what it would be like to be a real slave. And he loved that book. He bought me a copy to read. And if you're a slave, if you're an Eved, so of course, what does your clothing mean to you? What does your money mean to you? You don't have a yacht of your own. So it's a pass-through. You're just doing your thing. And that really, I think, was his mind frame. I don't know if even he would have said it himself, but I really believe that. You know, an Eved, if roll call is at Nates, so roll call's at Nates. You wouldn't miss it because you got to be there. And that's, he would say to me, if you had a plane to catch, you'd be able to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so you got a shachar to go to Nates. It was a pasha by him. One of my earliest memories of him, this sums it up. We were Davin Marv, there at Be'er Shmuel, I think it's called the shul there on Sorotskin. And it was right before Baruch Hu Friday night, and the Shliach Tzibur was about to start, and there's this little boy pulling at the, jumping up and down a little bit, pulling at the leg of the shot, and he's ignoring him. The father's ignoring the son. And it becomes evident to all of us standing behind that the child needs to go to the toilet, and he's jumping up and down. You remember? And seconds before it happened, before Baruch Hu, so you see this little river going down in a puddle forming beneath. And we're all staring in disbelief. And the Rav, without batting an eyelash, he took off his hat to throw, to cover the urine, because he knew you can't at Darshan Kedusha. Understand? And Shabbos, that was Rav. He berated himself that he was lazy. He said, I know what you think. You think Rav Luna Tzaddik, you'd be lazy, you work on the clock. But he said he knew in his heart he was lazy, and he really felt he had to fight that his whole life. And you know, everyone knows he famously didn't sleep very much. You heard the backstory there. He developed, when I learned with him, so he said, I'm going to sleep for 5 minutes, and after 5 minutes, just say Rav Luna Tzaddik, and I'll wake up. But he developed a technique, if he didn't have me to wake him up, because he'd take me from I don't know how long, from as a child. He would rest by closing his eyes, and he would put his tongue between his teeth, and he would doze off. Because when you fall asleep, your jaw closes, and you would then bite on his tongue, which would wake him up, so that he would get back to learning again. That was his technique for waking himself up when he needed to take a rest. It was said from this podium not long ago that friends, quoting someone, said that friends are for bored people. Now, Rav Milinus would not have accepted that. He really cherished his friends very much. He really had a phenomenal number of friends spanning the globe. He talked fondly of Tuvia back in Muncie and Solomon in New York and Leichter in Eretz Israel, and he really deeply, deeply cherished his friendships with Rav Stein and Dr. Ryan, Dr. Farak. Really, they were like, it would be hard for me to overstate how much he cherished those friendships, and he invested in them, and every time Dr. Ryan came to town, they'd go for breakfast together, and they had that same disgusting shachmanas they sent back and forth now for how many decades amongst themselves. And really, one of the highlights of his life, Rav Lunitz's highlights of his life, was when Dr. Ryan, he made a scene on Shabbos not long ago, and the three of them, like the boys, they took a Shabbos together to celebrate in the Neir Etzion. One of the highlights of his life, for sure. And he took a real pleasure in his friends. He would always remember asking a question, say, ask Rabbi Stein. He really loved his friends, and he kept an astounding number of deep. It's really astounding to me how many deep relationships he maintained. You know, it's hard to imagine someone so busy, but till the very end, really, he really invested in those relationships. They're really important to him. Same with his family, really. You know, I think as much as he was took joy in the siyum for Dr. Ryan, it's hard for me to understate how much he was looking forward to David Milinowitz's siyum on Shas, which is coming up next week. Really, he was, it would have been a new, it would have been really his, even bigger highlight of his life. He was so proud of David, and he was so proud of both children. He was so proud of his children, really. And he invested, just as he had invested in the in the friendships that he maintained. You know, he edited a family newsletter that would go out to keep the family together because the family was spread out. It was difficult for him. Someone in Pitzlar, somewhere here. And it was difficult for him, really. It pained him as some of his children were ended up going to Chutzlar. This was difficult. But he never missed a simcha, as far as I know. And the Rebbe and also go back even for siblings and nieces and nephews. He invested his heart and soul into his family. He kept in his pocket, this is something amazing to me. He kept in his pocket a photograph, in his wallet, a faded photograph of, I think, a great uncle of his. He held this uncle had encouraged his father to leave, to escape Europe before the war, and the uncle didn't survive. So he felt there was no one there to remember him, the uncle. So he kept a picture of this great uncle's picture in his wallet till the end, every day. So someone should be mindful of this uncle. I want to speak about the women of the family, of his family. It's worthy of mention. He really so admired his mother. He thought she had a tremendous influence on him. He was deeply grateful and fond of his mother in an extraordinary way. And his wife also. His wife, he really respected his wife, and he would speak things over with her. She was such a wise woman. He wouldn't make decisions without discussing with her. Many discussions. Many, many, many decisions. And his sister, he had an older sister. He told me 100 times how much Akaras HaTov he had for her, for Yeldi, that the sister sort of responsible for saving one of the children. It's a story. But he held she was such a wise woman. He referred people to her. All of them, really. It's something special. And the truth is that his daughters also, he would say, you know, because I was with Chavrusa and we learned many years, and the girls had, like everyone had, children had problems. He would speak over things with me about what's going on with the family, and he would process them, and so he would say, you know, it's like, you know, like, it's very difficult, but you know, but Rachel's good, you know. And when he said Rachel's good, he always meant one of two things. Either he meant she's a good wife, because the Rachel's very clear, he said, married women have it easy. Because Hashem said their job description is Ezer Kenegdo, they know what to do. And he held that star, and he really felt that his daughters, he was proud of his daughters, that they really fit that bill. And that they're really, Bali B'tachon, all the children, but he really felt that, you know, there was, when they were owned in the Sion, he really said they're good, he meant that it's difficult and it's painful and they're being torn apart by whatever the problem was. But that they're strong and they can do it, and they really have inculcated this B'tachon, and he was very proud of them, and the boys too. But to me, it's really interesting. He also really he saw many women as being having something to contribute to the Kehillah or the Kehillah. He really encouraged them, not as talented women, but as talented people. And there's this, he made this effort to, there's this woman who had a blog called Jew in the City. And he really encouraged her greatly to do what she was doing. And there's a woman now in Chicago, who Stephanie Pearson Argumon. He sent her 1,000 emails at least in different things and encouraged her that she was a writer and so to do things. Here in the shul, you know, he was very, oh, the word, but he respected and he really encouraged Mrs. Noel, my own issues, really, he like, each of those women have hundreds or maybe thousands of emails from him. He really invested in them and encouraged them to really sort of fulfill whatever they, and give what they could. It's worthy of note. And it's gone without saying, so I have to say it. You know, although he did fight the get bill, he would do, bend over backwards, he would go across the world to save one agun, if he thought there was a chance of saving a woman. He would drop everything, all his artful work and his whole life, and go wherever he had to go to do it. He something extraordinary, really. A stranger, I understand, a stranger. I think what really was conveyed a little bit today was from Nehemiah and Rav Stein, how he was like a real Baal Aliyah. He like went stage after stage after stage, and he pushed himself, and he grew, and he grew, and he grew. He told me that
he fell in love with Rav Noach Weinberg long before he ever met him, because there was a tape that he heard. The Rav Noach made a tape, and on the tape it said, this is Rav Noach said, the following mashal. If you see a five-year-old child, and the five-year-old child is learning how to read and write, that's so cute, that's so lovely, but if you come back when the child's 10, you're still holding them when they're 5 years old, so you know you're witnessing a tragedy. And if you see a 10-year-old child doing what 10-year-old children do, and it's very sweet, if you come back when you're there 20, and they're still doing what they're doing when they're 10, so you know you're witnessing a tragedy. It's a tragedy. So if Noah said, and if you're 20 and you haven't grown, with your full-grown 20 capacity and kishron and abilities, if you haven't grown and you're still holding by 30, doing what you're doing when you're 20, that's an even bigger tragedy. And 30 to 40, a bigger tragedy. And you really held that way. And that won him over to Noah. And he really, as you heard, he lived his life that way. But the Rav really felt that a person's, he felt his, and I guess every Jewish man's, Ikra's growth is in his Talmud Torah. So the Rav had a shita about Talmud Torah. He said there were two parts of Talmud Torah in this context I'm saying now. There's the qualitative part and the quantitative part. Those are my words on this. There's the qualitative part the quantitative part's easy. Quantity means you're just learning more. That goes without saying and goes on forever because Torah is infinite. But the qualitative part is that you learn how to learn. You're learning how to learn better. You're learning how to think better. You're learning how to understand a sugya better, take it apart better. So he held that a person has to stay in full-time learning at least as long as he's in that stage of qualitative growth. He held that if you were still learning how to learn, then you should be full-time learning. And if you've plateaued, as everyone does eventually, I guess, most people do eventually, if and when you plateau, so then if you're going to leave, so then you can leave to go on to do whatever you're going to do. When I was 29, so I was learning by Yitzhak Berkowitz's kolam, and Rav Berkowitz wanted to send me out to a position in London. And Rav Malinowitz was very against it. Rav Malinowitz had sent me to learn by Rav Berkowitz. Really one of the most... So they had a fight. They had quite like a vigorous fight if I should be going to Chutz La'aretz or not. And in the end, I did go, and Rav Malinowitz, he lamented that he had lost the battle for my soul. And it sounds melodramatic, but he was pained, and I think he was pained, really. Because I left, he felt premature. Later on, when I came, after 3 years in London, he told me to come back there. He said, I was looking to come back there, it's wrong. He said, come back to Beit Shemesh, we'll have a shul, I have a shul here, we'll make a kolel. You know, Mermusim came to run it, and we'll be Chavrus, like old times, come learn with me. So I moved to Beit Shemesh to learn with him again. That's why I ended up here. So in that time, in the last 10 years, let's say, so he so many times said this phrase to me. He said, my life is over. For 10 years, he was saying, my life is over. By which he meant, I believe, that the learning part of his life was over. He felt kind of as Nehemiah had really said, the next phase, the last phase, the third phase, whatever it is. He felt this was a different phase in his life. He really felt that he didn't have time to learn anymore, and it pained him terribly, and that the Kehillah work, in the art school work, even though I'm sure in the art school he learned who knows how many thousands of Dafim and the Rambans and the Midrashim, of course he was learning the whole day long, but he felt that wasn't learning. He really felt that if he couldn't take it apart at his pace, as he wanted, and to really plumb the depth of the principles at hand, that wasn't called learning. He said, my life is over. He meant that life. This was tzibur work, but it wasn't his ikker life. But I have to say, to his credit, and I think everyone here knows, that even though he said that, but the Rav continued to grow so, so much, and I think in the last 15 years, how he was mityaches with his family, and his children, and grandchildren, it's a different world from him as a... He grew, he changed. And I ran the shul in the second decade from the first decade, if you recall, he really changed it. And certainly in the last 18 months, when he's at the age of 65, anyone who has one eye in their head saw how the Rav, because of he saw what was necessary, he turned his entire way in which he related to the killer around and defeat him around. Really, that's certainly, Rav Jacobson has a hand in that and a schus in that, kol hakavod to him, but really, Rav Malinowitz, he transformed his personality and the way he dealt with congregants 180 degrees and became so sensitive and so gentle from just in the last 18 months. Which is extraordinary. And the growth at Halavai, Rav Nozri Yisrael Salanta, even one leader, really, Rav Noach, Rav Malinowitz changes his demeanor.
extraordinary, as a tremendous bali at the very end. I see Rav Melinda's workbook has arrived, so I'm gonna wrap up a little bit here. I don't know if the Rav had a favorite color. I doubt it highly. He did have a favorite food, which was hot dogs. He loved hot dogs. He hated steak, and they didn't have hot dogs on Shabbos because the Rebbe said it wasn't b'kavodik to have hot dogs on Shabbos. He did have a favorite word. I think his favorite word is ois gehalten. He really felt so deeply that a person needs to think things through and have a sheet on. He had a sheet on everything, but that person ought to have a sheet on everything and stand up for what they believe on. And it did not bother him if you disagreed with him. Adarava, he was so pleased if you disagreed with him, as long as you had a shita. He wanted people to be thought through, and that was really so much of his life was about having a cheshbon on why he did every little thing, and every word made a difference, which is why he was so extraordinary in art school. But everything, I'm sure, as the children, most of all, everything had to have a shita, it had to be nothing. He hated expedience, he wanted to be principled. It has to be driven by principle, what's right or wrong, and endless. And I'm going to read you, I'm going to end. Hashem was good to me, I did not break down once the whole thing, so really. I'm going to read you, in the end, I want to read you one email that he wrote. This is from 2005, it's not an email to me even, but it's, I hear the Rav's voice in the time when I end with this. The person wrote an email to the Rav saying, realizing that most people aren't really given to independent thinking is one of those things that takes a long time to realize if from certain circles, along with realizing that, quote, independent thinking is not an absolute virtue that some of us make it out to be, i.e., just the writer to Rav Linowitz, it's possible to be a sheep and be a really good person. To which Rav Linowitz responded, I must correct you. It's possible to be a sheep and be a good person. It's not possible to be a sheep and be a really, really as an inherently, authentically, and genuinely good person. Independent thinking, with very, very few instances that are forbidden by the Torah, is as close to an absolute value as there is. And he wrote in huge letters, underlined, italic, bold, why else did God give you that brain? The fact that the Romulus finishes up. He says, the fact that the concept has become outlawed in certain circles is tragic. And, as a showrunner of the world, probably historically necessary, as many tragedies are. But they're still tragedies. Hashem runs the world. It's probably historically necessary, as many tragedies are, but still tragedies.